This episode of AVXL was recorded on May 25th, 2017. We're going to talk about no projection cinema, the glories or the hell of television operating systems, which ones suck less, and what set-top boxes we're probably using instead. We're going to answer a big old dog pile of viewer questions, give you some ideas about why not all subwoofers sound the same, and what exactly is it, getting a little more technical, that changes the sound of headphones. And ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Robert Herron has finally gotten to see Archer Season 8 on something other than his phone. Why? Well, you'll find out in just a moment.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And we have nothing to say to you this week. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Oh, my goodness. Actually, we have a lot to talk about. We have a ton of viewer questions. Thank you so much. Keep sending them in to ask@avxl.com. You can tweet at AVXL. You can go to facebook.com/AVXL. Or one of the fastest and easiest ways to get a hold of Robert Herron and myself is to go to @RobertHerron
on the Twitter.
Or @PatrickNorton.
On the Twitter.
And if you can't find us there, we can't be found.
Well,
we do our best to answer everybody who tweets and emails. And
heck yeah.
And if we don't get to your email this week, it's a good chance we'll get to it next week.
I love hearing about what people are doing with the stuff they're either interested in or own and how they're dealing with home theater.
I mean, what are you doing? Are you installing a projector? Are you dreaming about new speakers? By the way, fantastic deal I tweeted out about this week from the crew at KEF. They're flat wall-mounted,
not in-wall
sound speakers. Not in-wall.
Nice.
There's nothing wrong with in-wall. There's actually some fantastic, fairly inexpensive in-walls, but those are not ideal for renters. But to say
usually
the very
not.
Least. But they're doing their T105 ultra-thin home theater system, which includes a subwoofer, and then five. Basically, it's a 5.1 system. They're selling it for $899.99, and it normally sells for $1,700. And that's KEF, direct.com/specials. Of course, I'm a big fan of their LS50s. Their powered LS50s are amazing. And I actually have another one of their home theater systems in my house. And those are designed to be mounted on the wall.
Nice.
And,
that makes it easy to get the imaging right where it should be.
Yes.
In terms of you want the sound to seem like it's coming out of the screen. And as we were just demonstrating amongst ourselves earlier, if the speakers aren't in the right spot, you can either lose audio performance,
right.
Things don't sound right. So, and to be able to hang them on the wall, too, is for the, I guess, the acceptance factor in terms of integrating stuff into a room. It's it's less stuff.
Spousal acceptance factors, I think what you were trying to say.
Or less stuff for a Roomba to run into.
Yeah, that's a big plus. Or just less stuff in the middle of your room.
Yeah.
And these are actually designed to be wall-mounted. Most speakers do poor and terrible things if you stuff them up against a wall, which is awkward if you live in a tiny space in New York City. Which also reminds me, my next home theater upgrade is actually going to be a acoustically transparent screen.
Oh, nice.
So I can put my center channel directly behind the screen without being muffled by the screen.
There's some good options.
We saw a couple of fairly affordable ones.
I like the woven screen designs a lot. Just they're a little more matte. They're a little less reflective if you're dealing with a hot projector or a hot setup in terms of the brightness. Mm-hmm. So you don't get like a super bright spot right in the center or something like that. They're good at off-axis viewing too. Just they're not ideal for everything, but
my living room is not wide enough to have much of an off-axis experience.
Okay, that's okay. Not that it's as critical in projection either. Not
speaking
like these LCD TVs.
Of off-axis experiences, we've gone through this sort of transition from traditional film and then digital projectors showing up in theaters. And then the next evolution of that, and Lord knows there's plenty of theaters that could use an evolution from their current projection systems, is no projection cinemas. Is this essentially a giant screen? Like, a 50-foot-wide screen, a 50-foot screen at the far end of your theater?
That would be it. One large display system. Now, these exist already in terms of LED signage. You'll see on the sides of the road for billboards. You'll see them used in stadium arenas in terms of very dense LED structures that are used to create the display. Each pixel is an LED, each subpixel. And that, and in essence, you can make any size display. And what caught my attention was Mr. Howard Luck, who is a film director and currently the director of standards at SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. And he tweeted out that DCI, the standards body, approved an LED wall by Samsung for cinema. Basically, no more throwing light across the room, as he put it. And this could really look amazing because you have that ability to do per pixel lighting, very similar to what an OLED does in terms of when the LED turns off, there is no light. So in a black room, that's going to look perfect. You also have incredible brightness output. This should make for terrific 3D displays in commercial cinema. It should also provide ample lightage efficiently for creating bright images, especially for 3D or other just general viewing. Color-wise, you can do exceptionally saturated colors with LEDs. So I imagine if DCI has approved it, it is probably exceeding the DCI spec, probably approaching 2020 in terms of color space. So I have no problem about the color. I have no, I can't think it would be anything but epic. But it would just be kind of odd to no longer see that light shining over your head through the room and then hitting the screen itself, rather than just the screen is now a large LED wall. So, given some of the demonstrations we saw too at CES this year, Sony and others were showing off various forms, and Samsung too in previous years have demonstrated either tiled systems for doing large format displays or these impressive video walls. And I keep thinking back to the one Sony showed off. They had a really funky name for it. I don't recall off the top of my head, but the density of the LEDs on that display, you could put your nose right up to it and barely see the structure. So you're going to be able to get terrific resolution on a panel like this. I can't wait to actually see one of these in operation to see how well it looks. I mean, a lot of us have seen LED signage, but they can do exceptionally dense, beautiful imagery with LEDs. So it doesn't have to be the billboard. Yeah. It can be something far more detailed.
We should also point out, you know, something we've talked about for years since the early days of high-definition televisions, when you could buy a 480p television or a 720p television was considered top of the line still, because you couldn't buy a 1080p television yet. Is, you know, when you're 30 feet away from a 50 or 60 inch screen, it is enormously difficult to tell the difference between 720p and 1080p. And, you know, when you're 25 to 50 feet away from a 50 foot display, it is enormously difficult to tell that those pixels are a quarter inch or a half inch or a 16th of an inch, you know.
I will say in some test rooms I've been in on large format displays for 4K, if you sit in the front row, generally you'll start to see the pixel structure. Hopefully they have the seating back far enough to where you don't notice that, but hopefully. Yeah, that's a potential. But I there's something about classic cinema and projectors that I absolutely love, and there's something I want to see an LED wall in a commercial installation, and just to see how it looks. I think it'll be fantastic, and the performance for contrast, brightness, and pixel performance should be excellent. So it's just something different. Not sure what I think of it really yet. I guess.
And before you ask, like, when is this going to show up in the home? It already is in the home. We call that plasma LED or OLED technology.
Most of us aren't doing LED wall installations, though. But they could make it easy enough.
Yet.
A rolling display, a roll-up display. Anyway, just something kind of interesting. Other interesting news this week, I have an MU9000 arriving in the lab here. And I'm looking forward to getting my hands on that. That is Samsung's next to the top of the line 4K TVs for 2017.
Is that essentially like last year's next to the top of the line, where basically you had the exact same glass and just the stuff that held it in place and came in the box next to it was the big difference?
This is, let's see, the Samsung QNOT is going to be their top of the line TV for this year. And that does have a very unique pixel structure that none of the other TVs they've released this year have. However, other features like a 240Hz panel, the advanced anti-reflective coating is going to be exactly the same as that they're using on the Q series for this new M9 or MU9 and the MU8 series as well. Cable management. It's got the cool in-frame cable management, so literally you can get it to one thin little cable running out the back of the stand. or it just makes the management overall just less cluttery. The odd display characteristic of the MU series compared to the new Q series coming from Samsung is going to be that these TVs do not use quantum dot tech to achieve their wide color gamut. What are they using isn't exactly known. I'm going to just assume they're using an enhanced phosphor-style LED as the backlighting system, something that basically can give it more saturated primary colors, red, blue, and green in particular. So I'll be curious to get my hands on this, see how it compares to the value TVs from last year. I'm going to assume that these panels at 1,000 nits will at least match the performance of the best TVs from last year. And exceed them in certain ways, especially with that AR coating, the anti-reflective coating. That's a big deal. And now that it's actually really good that I'm seeing on the 2017 sets too, it's just something I think will be more important for folks. But otherwise, I'm just looking forward to putting some test patterns through it, seeing how it performs, and then also digging a little bit more into how they're doing that expanded color palette exactly without quantum dot tech that they use in the Q series TVs. So. And I'm also itching to find out what's up with that Q9 and its funky pixels. And hopefully I'll be able to get some special lab time with that here soon. So.
Oh, my goodness.
But the MU9000, it arrives this week. Let's see, 55, 65-inch screen sizes. You know, the pricing isn't bad on these. They're already available. The 65-inch is currently listed at $2,300. The 55-inch, I want to say, is $1,800. I'm just guessing. But it's right in there. Good performance, good price. Likely these are going to be terrific for any of the current 4K sources, be it a game console for good response time. The wide color gamut support should be phenomenal. This is going to be their next iteration of just pixel processing, color processing, and everything. So I'm expecting these to be just a solid mid-range set that also includes all your wireless connectivity features too, like Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and blah, blah, blah. If you care.
Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and blah, blah, blah.
And blah, blah, blah.
Good old blah, blah, blah.
Blah-dee-dee-blah. But yeah, it's interesting that Samsung's got a mid-premium TV without quantum dot technology, because that's just something they've been throwing at every new TV lately. So, except this one, this series. So fascinated.
We got a bunch of viewer questions this week. At Shauna Tornado tweets, do they even make large screen TVs without smart, and then in brackets, spyware?
Smart spyware
features. And, on one hand, no. And on the other hand, as Robert points out, they are called projectors.
Most projectors have no Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or networking capabilities. Short of maybe for a firmware update or something like that. But
yeah,
that's the display I'll always go back to. That's the most pure in terms of just being a display, nothing else. No computing power, short of just pixel processing.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, there were some minor efforts for a short period of time by some smaller companies to offer dumb displays. But the reality is to be competitive on the shelves of Best Buy or or on Amazon.com or in in Costco or anywhere else you buy televisions, it has to have all these checkbox features. Does it do, does it do Amazon Prime? Does it do Netflix? And the reality is Shauna, yeah, I mean, it sucks because we've seen spyware, we've seen poor decisions, we've seen companies monetizing your viewing habits to provide additional revenue streams because it's impossible to make money selling television hardware.
And the other thing
that we've seen is like, I don't care about the operating system on a television anymore. As long as it turns on and gives Robert enough calibration settings to make the screen look good, I'm never going to use it. Never.
No. I'm looking at an external box.
Yeah.
And any TV, if it's not connected to the internet, you don't ever set up that network connection.
Yeah.
Then you know what? You have less to worry about in terms of it being a smart device. It simply won't be. And I understand the frustration, too, because you're paying for technology that maybe you don't want. And there really aren't that many options when it gets into the biggest screen sizes in terms of finding something that's just a display outside of the professional world that, I haven't seen a pro monitor with, you know, apps built into it. Yeah.
But most people aren't
calling out
to
the mothership.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most people aren't also like, you know, I'm going to pay $22,000 for a 35-inch, you know, optically pure
exactly.
viewing experience. But if you do, you will have a decided lack of operating systems on that, at least based on what we've seen. And it's, but yeah, it's frustrating because for me, the biggest issue is that even on some of the high end ones, the what I will affectionately call long term maintenance of the operating system has been kind of awful. Or worse yet, you know, they make a big deal like, you know, we've come up with the new, you know, Tizen, Amazon, Yahoo, Weasel, Dog Breath, Boxy, Aardvark, you know, I mean, whatever their particular flavor of that CES is. And then like a year or two later, they're moving on to the, oh, well, we've partnered with Roku, Android. You know, it's frustrating because, you know,
there isn't much follow-up on the OSs built into TVs unless right. there's a major issue or something like that.
Yeah.
They also do provide, you know, fixes for the software, hopefully, over time, that improve performance. One of the big complaints I hear about Android TVs, well, actually, there's probably another question related to this. I shouldn't even bring it up, but the TV needs to perform better over time. And I understand getting something out the door. Maybe there's a couple glitches. Software can be updated. But it's that over time, if it just becomes more and more bogged down as they just cram more crap into it
right.
without looking at the ecosystem itself, that's where I'm just like, oh, this is just annoying. And I would go for an external box at that point and ignore everything built into the TV.
Which brings us to @NatTheGooner, who tweets, if you can only have one device to connect to your 4K TV, what would you go for?
It's hard for me. If I had to pick one, it would be a game console.
Yeah, I'd probably go with a Roku.
Simply, or something like that.
You know, the high-end Rokus are fantastic.
Something with performance,
yeah.
Period. Yeah. And pretty much any box. And the one thing I love about the game consoles is that they generally are overbuilt for what they are. They're
right.
made to play, you know.
Well, they're underbuilt for 3D gaming performance compared to a desktop.
Yes. So, but they're really overbuilt for doing apps and stuff like that for your media consumption. So I've had those hold up for years on end, looking great and still performing. Still being updated.
Yeah.
The tough choice for me would be, you know, go with the PS4 that I kind of want, or do I get the Xbox One S that
Which has a Blu-ray drive?
Yes.
Sony, delete expletive, are you doing? Drop in the Blu-ray drive. Oh, wait, they want to make money distributing content over the internet.
Yep. So that's that. And I also always get a lot of positive feedback from NVIDIA Shield owners, another 4K set-top box that just seems to be a little more oomph than you're getting out of your standard.
Yeah. I mean, it's overkill for what it's doing in terms of performance. And if you're interested in streaming from your gaming PC to your living room, the NVIDIA Shield is fantastic. It's also, you know, my issue with it when it first launched was that there was a decided lack of Android applications on it, and it's gotten a lot better.
Good deal.
@BucketO tweets, what's your favorite TV OS for 2017? Is Android TV and the Sony's really the cat's meow? I think both of us love the less expensive to median price TVs with Roku TV.
That TCL one I got for my mom has the neatest menu system on it, where it can be simplified to just always just turn on and go to this one thing, or the menu is like written for real people. It's not just arcane technical jargon, blah, 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 blah. It's just, it's well laid out, and I like it.
Yeah.
I also appreciate
Hisense also does the Roku TVs.
And Hisense on the H8 I have in house right now, it has a history function right on the top page. So when I go digging in for some arcane setting, I don't have to go dig 4, 5, 6 menus deep to go find it again. It actually remembers those last 3 or 4 things I did and makes them accessible right from the top. And little things like that. And it's also a good looking menu with a logical layout to where everything is.
Right.
It's super easy to find. A buddy of mine who reviews TVs for a living has been living with one of the new Android TVs on a Sony for a few weeks now, and the frustration I hear from that interface currently is that it can get a little laggy. It's just like you push a button and there's a delay. And
I hate that.
And if you're trying to do calibration work where you're trying to pull up a specific setting or make an adjustment, anything that slows down that process is just, oh, you just want to beat your head against the wall sometimes. So yeah, it would be nice to see anybody doing reviews to also pay attention to just general usability, how smooth the menus can be scrolled through. And
part of the issue is that is so often the TVs that are sent out for evaluation to the major publications, whether they're online or on paper, are very, very early and don't have finalized software.
I've been there.
You have. You know, sitting, watching you stomp on buttons on a remote control while your face only, you know, turns from its generally tan to that bright red shade it only gets to when technology is failing in a completely inappropriate way.
I do love helping fix those kind of bugs, though.
Yes.
So that I'm good at. I know how to do that. But yeah, I understand. It's again, this is like abandon what's built into that TV. Try to leave it on the same input and throw the remote in a drawer and just leave it alone.
Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. One last television operating system related-ish question before we do a little AV101. At Scotty Tech tweets, and we got a couple more viewer questions. At Scotty Tech tweets, I use Roku to stream from my computer to my TV over HDMI. I want to add a soundbar to improve my experience. Awesome. And Scotty Tech asks, can you recommend a good one and to walk through the right way to set it up? The right way to set it up depends on the soundbar. It's kind of like, you know, you're either using the spit-if out from the television into the soundbar, or you're doing a pass-through involving the HDMI audio.
I prefer the optical out of the back of a set right into a soundbar, because then anything on that screen gets...
That's a big one.
It's simple. Yeah. You don't have to worry about HDMI handshaking or just the occasional glitch there. There are tons of great options for soundbars. That Sonos Playbase I looked at a couple
You're
weeks back.
With that.
It's just a fantastic sounding product. It is not.
The Playbar is really good too.
And that all of the Sonos products, but generally those are pretty pricey, like $700 or so for some. And
well, it's $700, and then to get the subwoofer, which you definitely. Well, here's the thing, right? Because you know, 30-40 hertz out of a speaker for music is pretty good, right? It's not perfect. But you're gonna get that like B flat off of a tuba when you're listening to Preservation Jazz Hall Band. You're gonna get like the low E on the bass, most of the piano,
the rumble from an explosion.
Right, but that's the thing though. If you want to have the full, you know, if you are watching the Avengers, what you want to have is that feeling of your chest collapsing under the weight of whatever horrible thing. The thing is,
yes,
not the thing. The green one, the Hulk. Goodness, it's not like I've been reading about. Oh goodness, the green, orange, rock, flesh. You know, beta rays. It's all good. But if you want to have like, you know, if the Hulk is like ripping the front off of a building or punching a giant alien dragon in the face and then collapsing some, you know, large concrete structure in Lower Manhattan, you want to feel it. And you know, when you have a really good subwoofer in your home theater, it is incredibly immersive because you are, you are feeling stuff that even to a certain degree below what you can hear, you can still feel. But mostly going down to 20 hertz in that situation, like music doesn't really need to go to 20 hertz unless you've, you know.
No.
If you're listening to like, you know, a bunch of stuff that's been recorded, you know, with an old school, like 300-year-old European organ where there's like bass pedals that are designed to make the entire cathedral shake and terrify the congregation. That's one thing. But most music doesn't really go down to 20 hertz or below 20 hertz.
And a lot of TV viewing, except for the things like explosions and the loud sounds and whatnot. And one of the reasons I mentioned that Playbase too is that it actually has an integrated sub that did a pretty good job. It sounded great. However, when I look at more value options, I look at the stuff Vizio has.
Yeah,
I've installed a few of them, and the difference between having one of their soundbars with a sub or without is subtle, but it is noticeable, and it's not much more.
Right.
And the setup on the last one I did was I actually used the mount brackets. You can buy universal soundbar brackets that let you attach the soundbar to the TV itself. I found it useful on a setup where we didn't have enough room at the bottom of the screen with the wall-mounted TV to put the soundbar on there. So we ended up mounting it on the top edge of the screen with the universal kit that just uses the same holes for where the wall mount goes, and it just makes it simple. A clean look. It also affixes the soundbar to the TV, so if it's on something like an articulated stand, it'll turn with it.
That's
awesome. It cleans up the look, and You have nothing besides a power cord running up to that. And then the subwoofer that we were using is wireless. So we just plugged that in and stuck it in the corner. And it works really well. Generally, yeah. I don't run into many issues with HDMI switching, but when it does, it can be frustrating, especially if you aren't comfortable maybe unplugging a cable and plugging it back in or turning everything on and off. And that's another reason I kind of go back to the optical output from the TV, because it's so simple. It's there. It's unpowered in a sense. It's just a stream of light. And there's very little interference with that either. So it's one of those things that just works. And for the sound sources you're going to be dealing with from broadcast or anyone, optical's fine. It's covering all your Dolby digital formats, DTS if it's there, in addition to regular stereo. So,
oh my goodness. We should also, I should also say, going down to 16 or 20, even 20 hertz on a subwoofer is a luxury.
Yes. And
just because it says it does rare. It on the box. Yeah. Subwoofer specs tend to be some of the most generous specs in the world of audio, which is saying something, because a lot of audio specs are
audio systems that can get into that range are... Those are earth movers.
Yeah, generally. If you want to go to Shoe Research,
there you go.
Yeah, if you want to see some of the most amazing subwoofer technology for the money, ShoeResearch.com, what they call their true subwoofers, which start with the VTF Mark III, and end up at the top of the line with like dual subwoofer systems, or for music like their craziest over the top one. I want to say it's like the VTF 15H Mark II subwoofer, which can go to 16 hertz if it's ported, or 22 hertz ported or sealed. And this is, when they give the measurements, like with one port, they have a one of the things that Dr. Shu has come up with is the idea of these having multiple ports that you can plug or leave open to tune, right?
Oh, okay.
Basically, you can either have maximum volume or maximum extension, right?
I like
so
that.
For his measurements, and something you notice, like a lot of speaker manufacturers, they're like 20 to 20 hertz, but they don't tell you, that it's negative 12 dB at like 14 hertz, or like negative 22 dB at 40 hertz.
If you put your hand on it, you can feel something.
You can feel something. Yeah, if you get your ear really, really close and play this scene from this movie, at positive 75 dB. But if you go to the Shoe Research website, you'll see the measurements, like low-end extension on these top-of-the-line subwoofers, are 16 hertz with one port open. That's negative 2 dB. That's 2 dB down, right? 21 hertz with two ports open.
Thinking, though, for just setup tips, though, in general, normally there's not a lot you're going to be able to do to a soundbar,
right?
Short of adjusting maybe bass treble settings and volume, of course. I find it one nice thing on the Sonos systems, at least on a lot of them, is that you're able to, with an Android or a iOS device, is to do a room correction and improvement using software, which is, it worked pretty well. So,
and location is a big deal.
I don't see it being similar on most soundbars. Most don't include setups. And I want to say, it is good to play audio you're familiar with. At least you might want to maybe knock the... Maybe it comes out of the box a little too bright, and you want to knock that treble down by one, or you want to bump up the bass by one. Those are usually the max adjustments you're going to be doing there. Otherwise, it's a soundbar. You're going to keep it near the TV, above it or below it, and the sub you have some flexibility with, especially if it's wireless.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it is a terrific upgrade overall. I mean, in terms of... the hearing of dialogue to everything. It's just it improves any TV, especially the ultra thin flat ones that really have no room for speakers to begin with. So,
oh my goodness. By the way, Shoe's entry level sub is a fantastic deal. It's $399.
Mm-hmm.
22 hertz with one port open. That's 2 dB down. 32 hertz with both ports open. Yeah,
Okay.
He's got full frequency response.
If you want
those.
The boom.
Well, yeah,
talk
I mean,
to Mr. Shu.
With one port open, your maximum SPL at 20 hertz is a 100.2 dB. It's a CEA 2010 rating of 107.7. With two ports open, the CEA rating is 108.2, and it's 103 decibels at 25 hertz. I mean, it's a subwoofer can do fantastic things, especially if you have smaller speakers. Bad subwoofers deliver crappy bass. Cheap subwoofers all too often deliver crappy bass. I want to say it's, was it Brent Butterworth who did the Wirecutters article with the monoprice subwoofer?
Right.
That's a really great one to read, too. So
that's the other thing. You may not need a sub. I find older clients that I deal with are more interested in the treble side of it, or the brighter sounds, the dialogue, and things like that. It's more important to get that right for some people mm-hmm. than to be able to hit 20 hertz or something yeah. like that. That's, or some people don't, they don't like that boomy. They don't. Right. They don't want as much boom. So,
well, but the other thing is a well set up subwoofer shouldn't be boomy all the time. It shouldn't
exactly.
feel like you're sitting next to that 15-year-old kid, you know, 16-year-old. It's driving age in California. 17-year-old kid at the stoplight, you know, whose hood is blowing off, and you can hear the trim rattling loose from his car.
I love seeing body panels rattling away. Yeah. Rattling away.
It brings a certain joy, right? But you know,
yes,
the monoprice 9723, which is Brent's pickup at the Wirecutter. You know, is like $110. And sometimes you can get that 20% off if it's in stock and monoprice is doing a sale. You know, that's, you know, and it delivers good quality bass. And Brent, as far as I know, has benchmarked more subwoofers than anybody else alive at this point. And if he says it's a good deal, I assure you it's a good deal. And if you do decide to buy that, you know, subwoofer, do me a favor, go to thewirecutter.com. We got a link in the show notes and use their link because it helps keep the Wirecutter making amazing stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So I talked last week, we had a question from at Ruari who asked, what is it that makes on-ear headphones sound different? Cheap ones have poor quality, $100 ones do not. And one of the things I mentioned, for example, the Sony MDR-7506s, which typically sell for like $75 or $80, have fantastic quality.
Classic engineering headphone.
Yeah, you know, it's a great starter headphone. But I wanted to add some clarity, right? Let's kind of start from the outside and work in. There's the housing or the ear cups. The material and design impacts how the headphone sounds. And like I said last week, everything impacts how the headphones sound. It is a collection of things. And if you make changes here, it changes things over there, right? These are highly engineered systems that are difficult to create. But are the ear cups made out of plastic? Are they metal? Are they wood? Are they liquid wood that's been compressed and molded? Are they mostly wire screen on the back? Are they closed? How is it vented or damped? What do they stuff inside? For example, a lot of headphones have a particularly chosen sort of fabric-y, papery kind of thing that's in between your ear and the driver, or maybe they use that on the vent holes on the back. You know, classic Grado mod is to poke holes in the dampening material in the headphone to boost the bass, right? So when you look at the number of holes behind the driver or in front of the driver and what's covering those holes, that can actually impact the sound or increase or decrease the treble or bass. Some classic headphone mods, stuffing the ear cups with modeling clay or speaker filler, you know, foam. Headphone hack to like ease up low end is to put fiber filler inside of. That's something a lot of people used to do to Denon headphones. The Fostix T50RP is like a modder's headphone. It is pretty impressive out of the box, but there's not a lot of low end. And then this entire modding culture popped up around that. People put non-hardening modeling clay inside the baffles in the ear cup to reduce vibration. They put foam inside there to reduce sound wave reflections.
I was kind of wondering if anybody did a headphone where it was a kit where you had some flexibility in terms of making choices like that.
Well, they don't really do it as a kit, but if you start searching,
the community has taken over.
If you go to like
that, I understand. We'll figure it out. We'll get a link in the show notes.
Well, I want to say that the headphone T50RP mod thread on HeadFi
must be seen.
Yeah. Well, I want to say it's like up to 300 pages. Are they
okay?
Fostix T50RP incremental mods and measurements on headfi.org.
Nice.
Let's see. It's at least 155 pages. Yeah, it's up to 155 pages now.
Dive in, people.
Businesses have built around modding or creating kits to mod T50RPs. You know, a good place to learn a bit about that, interfidelity.com. Tyler Hertzen over there, he's good people. He has tons of measurements of modded T50RPs. And pretty much every major headphone, he's got measurements on there. And he's got some great discussions of measurements, what they're good for, what they're not good for. It's a fantastic resource.
I like that.
Yeah, Tyler's good people. Interfidelity.com is the website. You know, going back to kind of working, you know, from the outside in, is there a front plate between your ear and the driver that's been engineered to dampen and control the sound? Is the headphone open or closed back, right? Closed back isolates background noise better, giving you sort of a cleaner audio experience. But open back tend to deliver a more sense of space, a larger sound, get the sound more outside of your head. A lot of people consider it more realistic. There are closed back headphones with epic sound staging. I'm looking at you, Mr. Speakers. Your planers are amazing. You know, and he just, you know, or the crew at Mr. Speakers just released the Aeon, which is about half the price of their premium headphones. You know, and yes, they're $800. They were pre-selling those for $700. They're closed back. They're much more travel friendly than the sort of Ether C Flow or the Ether C, and they're half the price and they sound incredible. But you know, you don't have to give up sound staging to have closed headphones, but generally speaking, you know, more often than not, the open headphones are going to give you sort of a better sense of the room or the instruments.
That's been my experience too. Although I love isolation for headphone use. So
yeah,
for that, I'm typically,
but that's the thing,
the can,
right?
So
one of the best things you can do to improve your home theater experience or your audio experience is to be someplace where there's no noise.
Exactly.
Which is why I do a lot of my headphone listening after everyone else in my house is asleep.
Home theater rooms are also good just to sit quietly in.
Oh, my goodness. Just, yeah, read a book. So then there's the drive. So we talked about sort of the ear cup, right? The actual housing.
Yeah.
There's obviously the driver itself, right? And the driver is a diaphragm, a voice coil, a magnet, and a frame. You know, and that's where the rubber hits the road, right? This is the thing that actually converts electrical signal into the sound pressure or the sound that hits your ears. How big is it? Headphones typically have 20 to, you know, over ear or on ear headphones typically have 20 millimeter to like 50 millimeter drivers. What's the diaphragm made of? Generally speaking, lighter and stiffer is better. You know, could be mylar plastic, could be paper, biocellulose, or what I affectionately think of as you know, worm poop. The amazing AudioQuest Nighthawk and Night Owl use biocellulose. Sort of B&W's headphones. There's some high-end Sony headphones that use biocellulose because it's incredibly stiff. Aluminum, pure beryllium in the Focal Utopia, which a lot of people consider the best dynamic driver headphone in the world right now. It's a $4,000 headphone. Beryllium's a nightmare to work with. But it also, that and their incredible voice coil design allow them to do extraordinary things in terms of the extension and not having reflection issues. That said, planar magnetic and electrostatic headphones aren't exactly stiff. They have a sheet of material that the thinner, the better, generally speaking, but they're also not traditional dynamic, you know, driven or dynamic drivers in a headphones. How good is the motor, the windings and the magnets, the frame? How stiff is it? Is there a frame? You know, is the ear cup the frame? Is the ear cup stiff enough to, you know, keep the diaphragm from distorting? Does the diaphragm in the driver, you know, does it have a free edge with a flexible material that allows it to have, you know, good extension without distorting the surface of it? Or, you know, is it basically a piece of mylar plastic that goes all the way to the edge of the frame so that when you play louder, it actually starts to introduce distortion? Again, the magnet, the motor, you know, the ear pads. I think ear pads are mostly comfort, but they can definitely influence bass. They can absorb or boost highs. Leather or pleather offer a better seal, which can give you a better sense of the bass. Ear pads can change the distance or orientation of the driver to the ear. A lot of the change that ear pads deliver depends on the headphones and your ears and how sophisticated you are in your listening. Plastic, velour, leather, protein leather. You know, there's memory foam, aftermarket headphones, leather. It's there's kind of a crazy, a number of options, right? Sure, 840 pads are a classic, you know, pad that's been modified to fit on a lot of different headphones. For example, those T50 RPs.
Oh, yeah.
The Daconi Audio leather ear pads I bought for my Fostex T50 RP. I think they have more low end, but they're like 900 times more comfortable than the thin, cheap-ass plastic, you know, vinyl ear pads that are, you know, a quarter inch thick that came with it. They're big and they're thick and they have memory foam and they give me a great seal. And I think that really increases the low end, but mostly it makes me not want to take them off after 15 minutes. You know, our friend Michael put Brainwaves memory foam velour pads on his Sonys and he went from like the beat up ear pads that were on there to something that was much more functional because they created a better seal.
Oh, okay.
They made it more comfortable. I've played around with stock leather and larger angled velour pads on my Hi-Fi Man 400 planar magnetic headphones, and it's interesting to sort of tweak and mod, and it's also the kind of rat hole you can go down forever. I know you didn't
ask about the proximity of these speakers to your brain and your ears, and it is truly everything in terms of every little design characteristic influences how you're perceiving that soundstage and that sound field.
Sure, and a lot of headphone engineers would be like, don't change the ear pads. I did this intentionally. But you know what? They're your headphones. Go nuts.
Yep. Be artistic.
Some folks have mentioned cable quality, too. I don't hear a lot of differences between cables, although I do like a cable that doesn't fall apart when I actually use it.
Yep.
But making your headphones comfortable is a big deal, and headphones that are designed in a way where they don't clamp your head or they don't, you know, make your ears feel like they're about to fall off because the blood's been pressed out of them. In-ears, man, you've got like the driver or multiple drivers, the crossover if you have multiple drivers for your in-ears, the housing material and design, the nozzle shape and design. You know, drivers are, you know, in in-ears are often balanced armatures or multiple balanced armatures, which take up less space than sort of a tiny speaker in there. And the tips, if in-ears don't seal properly, you're not going to have any bass and you probably have a compromised high end. So, you know, are they custom fit? Are they silicone? Are they foam? Are they rubber?
Are they getting that driver right where it needs to be for your enjoyment?
So I'm going to stop talking about headphones now, but when I say that everything impacts it, all these things can be tweaked and modded by the engineer or by the end user to modify the sound, and they all impact the sound, some things more, some things less. Quick viewer correction from last week. At Mike Shea points out, I tweeted, listening to the last AVXL, wanted to mention YouTube TV includes the Red Originals, not the full ad-free YouTube experience at Patrick Norton. And thank you. Thank you, Mike.
I do appreciate that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I think we can do one last question. And
all right.
Should we, well, this.
I am just rolling through here.
I'll tell you what, at RG Herrera tweets, TV that supports Bluetooth or some type of wireless audio.
Most of the mid to premium TVs will have integrated wireless, including Bluetooth. That makes it easy then to link like your favorite pair of Bluetooth headphones or an external speaker. I do that all the time with a lot of sets I own, actually, just for convenience. Convenience listening, private listening, or just to make the put the sound outside the house or something while the TV's still running or whatever. So, yeah. Adding Bluetooth to that setup isn't, you have to get some dongle or something like that, but, and then you'd be taking probably analog output from a TV to do it. So when you're shopping for the sets, one nice thing about those smart TVs is in addition to Wi-Fi, they usually include Bluetooth as well.
Right.
On the mid to high end, sometimes on the value smart sets, you'll find that's one feature that gets chopped. It'll have Wi-Fi built in, but not Bluetooth. And it's useful enough where I like having that built in, especially for headphones and speakers. It's just absolutely cool.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, next week we're going to get some more viewer questions in there. Andrew Ruth tweeted looking for a short throw projector that is not DLP for under $3,000. That one might be a little bit difficult, but we'll do our best on that one. We got a certain question from a certain viewer about TV size, and you'll get an early answer on email. Well, he's looking for a 55 or 65-inch model.
Perfect.
And Josh from New Jersey asks about LUT boxes.
A awesome topic.
Oh,
I look
forward
to diving into that. I've seen people do bad things with LUT boxes.
Look up tables and video aren't always
They can be
the
amazing.
Answer.
And I wish actually TVs had those built in, but or at least user-accessible ones. But anyway. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll dive. Dive.
You're still in love with Vincent Teo's YouTube channel.
You know, he has been on a roll lately. He is a pro reviewer, and he has a channel up on YouTube. And this week he showed off a video where he had three of the latest OLEDs side by side, each configured using a different tone mapping technique. So you could see with the exact same 4K UHD content how the setup from the manufacturer with content that exceeds the performance of the display, how the manufacturers can go about tweaking that image to maybe produce a brighter image while sacrificing detail, mm-hmm. or doing reference quality imagery, yet at the same point, you're not able to hit the full spec. So where do you make the trade-offs? And if you're curious about what tone mapping is in the HDR world, it's a great video, and it's well presented, and the side-by-side is just easy to look at in terms of just seeing the differences with arguably some of the very best TVs out there right now. So shout out to Vincent and his terrific work. And he's a terrific guy. I'm almost certain I've met him a few times. So at various trade shows and whatnot. And I'm just I learned a little bit of something from that video, and it was nice just to see it in the side-by-side demonstration to help verify some of the things I see out in the field right. All the time. So
it's nice when somebody other than you sees what you've been seeing. I'm not mad.
or you come up with a better way of explaining it to somebody that you can show them visually. Right. It's like, here's why I'm doing what I'm doing, and here's why you want to avoid that particular setting. Or, you know, it all depends. But
you finally got the FX app to stream your Chromecast Ultra so you could finish up Archer Season 8.
I'm sick of watching it on my phone. So, yeah, every time I went to hit the play button, it just sit there and spin and spin and spin. It would never kick over, and I think the app updated or something. So now I've got 1080p or greater Ultra HD Archer Season 8. I guess the final episode posted, and I am curious to see how it ends.
Oh, my goodness. I mentioned last week we'd be talking about some more of the extraordinary creators and actors and actresses and directors that have passed in 2017. And one of the big ones for me was Sir John Hurt, I want to say back in January. And if you've never seen Sir Hurt act, you probably have. I mean, this is the guy, the Elephant Man, Alien. I won't drop any spoilers on 1979's Alien, but, you know.
Oh.
John Hurt, big role.
Yep.
Big noticeable role in that one. He also is in King Lear. He played Ollivander in the Harry Potter movies. That's the creepy guy that sold the wands. V for Vendetta. He spoofed his role in Alien in Spaceballs.
Oh, I forgot about that.
By the way, completely unrelated to Sir John Hurt, man, Blazing Saddles is funny, and it's on Netflix right now.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I think I bought that on Blu-ray for some reason.
Just because it's awesome. Sir John Hurt, you might have seen him in Snowpiercer. He was Winston Smith in 1984. He was living on a space station in Contact. He was Aragorn's voice in the Lord of the Rings animation. He played the voice of Hazel in Watership Down, Midnight Express. He was Caligulus and I, Claudius. Caligula and I, Claudius. It's not like I've been reading that name for 30 years. Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy. He was Control. I've never seen his first big roles in A Man for All Seasons and The Naked Civil Servant, but I'm going to track those down. I didn't realize he was in Jackie. He plays Mrs. Kennedy's confessor. That's the 2016 movie about Jackie Kennedy. Love and Death in Long Island. And one last thought, because I'm still, of course, obsessed with slowly watching American Gods roll out on Stars. Netflix, you've ruined me for watching things week by week. That said, boy, I'm really excited about...
I can't start a new show if there's only like one or two episodes
so
available. I have to just ignore it until there's at least
I've also
a good
been
handful.
Fighting an angry raccoon in my backyard and you know, refinishing some windows. So it's not like I had a lot of time to watch 22 episodes of something. But
no.
I didn't realize Ian McShane and John Hurt both debuted in 1962's The Wild and the Willing. Ian McShane, of course, being Swearengen from Deadwood and Odin in American Gods. But yeah, I now have to track down an obscure film from 1962 just to see what those guys looked like when they were like 12. Sir John Hurt, 205 roles. Damn. Some magnificent, magnificent work. So,
and it looks like a few more movies.
Oh, yeah.
With his credits coming out this year.
Post-production. I'm always fascinated when movies come out after the actors have passed. It's a little strange.
There is something tingly about that.
Tingly.
I don't know the right word.
If you're feeling tingly right now because of just how awesome the AVXL podcast is, we would like to respectfully request, please go to patreon.com/AVXL and become one of our patrons. We got a hangout coming up for our patrons and to everyone who contributes to patreon.com/AVXL. Thank you so much. We appreciate
indeed
what you do. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we got to bounce. And do us a favor, email ask@AVXL.com or tweet at Robert Herron or at Patrick Norton or at AVXL. I'm Patrick Norton.
I am Robert Herron.
We'll see you next week.